the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Medina. We have a special guest, an old friend on the podcast today, Dr. Samuel Gregg. He's the director of research at the Acton Institute. He's the author of a new book, Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. He's written a lot of books, Becoming Europe, Tea Party Catholics are a couple that come to mind. One of the things I really like about Sam is he's able to speak to just so many issues in the public square today. He gave a great address. I think it was one of my last Acton universities on the dictatorship of relativism. You can check that out on YouTube. I listened to that again the other night, and he just made the important point that moral relativism is often operating as a dictatorship in our nation today and around the world. So, Sam, how you doing?
Ray, it's very good to be talking with you, and it's good to be talking with Brooke as well. We have a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm making my way through some of Bach's cantatas, so I wanted to jump into your book. I know that's related to Western civilization. How do you define Western civilization, and what important role might truth or religion play in that definition?
Well, the very phrase Western civilization, as you and Brooke both know, is a loaded term these days, right? To say there is a thing called Western civilization, it's controversial. And then you get into the subject of, okay, well, if there's this thing called the West, and maybe not everything about it is as wonderful as we think it is. Maybe there's some bad things to Western civilization, and that's certainly the message you pick up in a lot of the academy today. But one of the things I think is important is that defining Western civilization goes beyond things like geography, right? Because we think of the West as basically sort of Europe, North America, etc. Well, there are countries that are clearly Western, like my native Australia, or a country like Israel, or a Latin American country like Chile. They're clearly Western countries, but they're not geographically located in this particular space in the Northern Hemisphere. But also, I think, when you look at defining the West, you know, you often do it in terms of what is not Western, things that are clearly not part of what you might call the central tradition of the West, etc. But then you look at other situations, like you say, well, is a country like Japan, is that a Western country? Well, it's certainly a modern country. It's certainly adopted a lot of technology and ideas that have come from Europe and North America. But I think people would hesitate, including Japanese people themselves, before they called it Western. So I basically think that it comes down to a few things. One is the West attaches importance to the idea of freedom, the idea of liberty. I think that's very much part of what it means to be part of the West. I think also, even at a deeper level, the commitment to reasoned inquiry in search of truth is also very distinctive of Western culture. And I also think that another defining aspect of Western culture is this particular integration between the world of reason on the one hand and the world of faith on the other, and the particular way in which the world of faith and the world of reason related to each other, integrated themselves with each other, shaped each other, I think is fundamental to understanding what Western civilization is, but also some of the problems that we're facing today.
Yeah. In terms of those problems, I mean, you kind of lay out a case there at the beginning of your book that some of the most important problems aren't politics or economic problems. And this gets into, you know, your understanding of a material world or how materialists might view the world around them. But unpack that a little bit in terms of what is really the central pivot point of problems we might be facing or decisions we might need to be facing in the West in terms of curing some of our ales?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, I think a key dimension of Western culture, Western civilization, is this particular integration of reason and faith. And what happens, I think, is that when that relationship becomes lopsided, or when it starts to disintegrate, or when faith and reason start to be seen as being at odds with one another, you run into trouble. But at an even deeper level, I think, a lot of this comes down to, a lot of the problems facing the West today come down to our understanding of who God is. And by the way, you don't need to be a religious believer to understand the importance of this. And one of the things I think that the West has at its core, and this goes back, first of all, to the Jewish people, to the Hebrew people, the Hebrew prophets, and then we find it in the Greeks, certain Greek thinkers, and then we see this particularly advanced by Christianity, is this notion that God is not simply love. Obviously, he is love. Christians believe that God is love. But we also believe, Christians also believe, Jews also believe, that God is also logos. And that's the Greek word for divine reason. And the idea that God is divine reason, that he is reason incarnate, we first find this really expressed, I think, in the Hebrew scriptures, particularly in the Hebrew prophets, when they talk about the capacity of human beings to know and understand the world, which they did, I should add, over five centuries before the Greeks started arriving at similar conclusions about the nature of God. And Christianity, of course, takes this idea of God as reasonable and transmits it through Western culture. And if you want any proof of this, you just have to look at the very first line of the first chapter of the Gospel of John, where it begins by saying, "In the beginning was the Word." And the word used in the Greek is logos. Logos. So what does this mean? It means that God is reasonable. It means God is not an arbitrary creature like the Greek gods, who, as you know, were capricious, nasty beings who spent their time messing around with each other's lives and messing around with human lives. If you view God as logos and suddenly there is a beginning and an end to time, history acquires a linear dimension. Things make sense. The world is rational. Human beings are rational. Now, of course, human beings are also fallen. They're weak and they make mistakes. But this concept of God as logos is fundamental for reconciling reason and faith in the Western tradition. And when we lose sight of that, when we lose sight of God as logos, then the relationship between faith and reason starts to corrode and even comes to be seen somewhat at odds with one another. Until we really...
So, Sam, I'm sorry. I just wanted to hop in real quick on that note, because I think really what you're driving home is this paradox of reason and faith. And I feel like that's something that's really, really lost nowadays. And we have this world, especially as it's portrayed in our political lives, wherein there is no room for nuance, and it's just black or it's white. And I mean, are you seeing, is that really where the erosion is beginning at, is just an inability for people to appreciate these paradoxes? I know G.K. Chesterton talked a lot about this in Orthodoxy, and you know, just this the importance of having one foot on the earth and one in fairyland. But can you speak a little bit to that and our growing inability to really appreciate these nuances and appreciate paradox?
Sure. Let me give you an example. Today, it's the idea of reason is widely understood in terms of empirical or the natural sciences. So reason is what we can measure. Reason is what we can observe and engage in experimentation. And that's true. Reason does have that dimension to it. But empirical reason, the natural sciences, things like chemistry, physics, or even social sciences like economics. These are all very important things. They have made life a lot more pleasant for all of us over the long term. But those things cannot give us a reason for why we do the natural sciences in the first place. They can't give us a reason for why we care about things like life and health. Moreover, when something like reason gets reduced to something like the natural sciences or empirical sciences, then the capacity of us using our reason to answer philosophical and moral questions, well, that's just reduced to subjectivity. So moral questions, even political questions, become a question of, well, that's just subjective, that's just preference, that's just a question of emotions. But of course, those questions are not issues of emotions. And certainly if you work within the broad Jewish and Christian traditions, you know very well that things like philosophy, things like the moral sciences, etc., these are not purely subjective things. These have a strong objective right and wrong dimension to them. But that's what happens when you separate reason from faith. The paradox is that reason starts to actually shrink in terms of what confidence we can have in a reason's ability to understand not just the world, but how we ought to act in the world, act towards each other, but also how we view ourselves as human beings. So ironically, separating reason from faith, which often means denying the idea of God as logos, what that typically means is that far from becoming more powerful, far from becoming more able to comprehend the world, reason actually shrinks. Our capacity to understand the world and live in it actually starts to shrink when we throw the idea of faith in a God who is divine reason out the door.
Sam, let me ask you a question about the Enlightenment, because we definitely see the explosion of reason in a lot of Western culture, at least how we maybe understand it today. What are some negative and positive aspects of the Enlightenment thought that can really help us, I think, navigate some of these questions we're dealing with, not just in the political realm, but just cultural as well?
Sure. Well, that's a good question, because in my experience, when you talk to most believers, religious believers, especially Jewish and Christian believers, what you typically find, especially let's call them small-o Orthodox believers, what you typically find is a high degree of suspicion of the Enlightenment. And I use the plural expression deliberately, because we often make the mistake of thinking the Enlightenment was one big thing, one big monolithic thing. But it wasn't. There were different Enlightenments. There was a Scottish Enlightenment. There was an English Enlightenment, a French Enlightenment, German Enlightenment, Italian Enlightenment. There was even an American Enlightenment. And they all embodied quite different views about religion. In fact, most Enlightenment thinkers, contrary to what we often hear, were not anti-religious. And in some cases, like someone like Isaac Newton, who's of course seen as the epitome of the Enlightenment, the man who personifies the whole Enlightenment project, guess what? He's a believing Christian. He took theology and faith deadly seriously. And if you look, for example, at the Scottish Enlightenment, which of course exerted enormous influence over the foundation of American modern culture and the shaping of the American experiment and all of that, most people involved in the Scottish Enlightenment turn out to be ministers of the Church of Scotland, who saw no conflict between, let's call it small o Orthodox Christian belief, and the new learning that was opened up by the various Enlightenments. And when we're talking about this, what we're talking about with the Enlightenments is this commitment to reason, particularly the empirical and social sciences, trying to understand what's actually happening in the world. And this is not in any way somehow contradictory with the use of reason that we find when people engage, for example, in theology when they engage in philosophy, which of course involves the use of reason to try and discern theological truth and philosophical truth. What the Enlightenment did was take the empirical method and start applying it, not just to the natural sciences, but to social sciences as well. So things like, this is why, for example, economics, which at the Acton Institute we spent a lot of time talking about, it's really very much a social science. It's trying to understand what is going on in the world. And none of this has to be in some way in contradiction with faith. It does not have to be in contradiction with faith. And for the most part, it wasn't. Now, there were Enlightenment thinkers such as Voltaire, Rousseau, who clearly rejected Christianity. They weren't atheists, but they clearly rejected Christianity. There are other Enlightenment thinkers, someone like David Hume, for example, who's clearly an atheist. Or someone like Adam Smith. Now, Smith is not a Christian, but he's not an atheist. He's very much a type of deist thinker. So my point is that the Enlightenments are a very complicated phenomena. And it's a mistake, I think, for religious believers just to reject the whole thing whole as bolus, as being completely wrong, completely in antagonistic towards the very idea of faith. Because when you look at the historical record, it's simply not true.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you mentioned the Scottish Enlightenment. Of course, you have many ministers that come out of this, and it's really a high tide in Scottish culture, intellectual right. culture, and theology. And let's just the book is Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. So people listening now, they wonder, I think, Sam, they may know that the West is declining. It's kind of weird in many ways. We live in this period of great decline, potentially in the West. There's a lot of positive things, but there's some negative things. But help us, you know, is decline inevitable for us? I mean, are we re-paganizing our culture? Are we just kind of slowly simmering down the drain? And what's a way to kind of get out of that rut?
Well, I think it's fair to say that if one looks at the state of Western culture today, then I think it's very hard to deny that it's in a state of decline. Why do I say that? Well, I say that because relativism is rife, not just in terms of day-to-day living, but even philosophically speaking. Skepticism is widespread, skepticism being the idea that we really can't know very much about the world outside the empirical and natural sciences. We have large numbers of the academy who deny the very idea of human freedom, yet they deny the idea that we have a will and we can make choices. We find a lot of public discussion is driven by, frankly, emotivism. I always say, I'm sure Ray's heard me say this before, but whenever a student in a seminar says to me something like, I just feel that, or they ask a question that begins with, don't you feel that? I always stop them and say, no, we're not here to talk about your feelings. We're not here to emote to each other. And I'm not interested in your feelings. I'm really not. What I'm interested in is your mind. I'm interested in your reasoning, because that is what makes us distinctive from the animals. Now, I can assure you that in most philosophy departments today, the very idea that there is truth is problematic, it's seen as oppressive, etc. So, yes, if you look at things that way, or even if you look at a lot of contemporary architecture or a lot of contemporary art, it's very hard to deny that a lot of Western culture is not in good shape. But I don't think decline is inevitable, because I don't think in terms of a type of determinism, that things are bound to go a certain way. My view is that the way back, and I say this very explicitly in the book, that there has to be a common commitment to a very full-bodied idea of reason that includes the empirical and social sciences, which is the Enlightenment thing, but also goes beyond that. But I think that in turn, that commitment to a full-bodied idea of reason really does depend upon whether if there's a God, I certainly believe there is a God, and whether we call him Yahweh or First Cause or Divine Providence or Supreme Being or Jesus of Nazareth, this God must be Logos, whose rationality and whose freedom is reflected in our reason and our ability to make choices to know and choose the truth. So in the end, without Logos, the West is clearly lost. But the free choice to know the Logos and therefore know the proper relationship between reason and faith is never beyond human beings. We can always go back down that path. So to that extent, I'm not a pessimist. Yes, things are pretty bad, but I don't think it's inevitable that the West will basically fade away. I think that if there's enough people who come to an understanding of this importance of reason and the way that it must reflect a particular understanding of God, does and can give us hope.
So, Sam, you know, we're seeing a lot of response from those on the right who really want to, they're concerned with Western decline. Politicians, in some ways, their concern is manifesting in a desire to bring manufacturing back to the United States, for example. So they're looking at Western decline when it comes to education. We're falling behind other nations in educating our K-12 population. There is less manufacturing, or less manufacturing jobs, should I say, in the U.S. and things like that. And so the expression of this concern has manifested in something that people like Senator Marco Rubio, and I think maybe Senator Howley has used this term as well, of common good capitalism. And so there are those that at least Senator Marco Rubio is a professing Catholic and believes that this is consistent with his Catholic faith as well as the Western legal tradition. And so my question to you is, how would you, what is your response to that as someone who I understand you to be a classical liberal and believe in the importance of free markets and free will? So how do you respond to those that are growing calls on the right for common good capitalism or constitutionalism?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. Now, the first thing I'd say is that the group of people that you're talking about, they don't agree about everything. And they also emphasize different things. So in the case of someone like Senator Rubio, he's not calling for a wholesale rejection of the American founding. He's not calling for taking liberty less seriously. What he's calling for is for specific types of policies, primarily economic policies, which he believes are necessary if we're going to be living in a society that's more than an economy. Now, my response to that is I think that it's a noble idea, and of course the idea of the common good is something I certainly subscribe to, but I think that there's a lot of bad economics informing much of his position, especially when it comes to things like trying to use industrial policy to deal with any number of problems in the United States, which I've argued in different places actually have very little to do with the economy and have much more to do with some of these social questions which we've been talking about. So that's one thing. So there's that type. There's also, however, a growing number of people such as Professor Adrian Vermeule of Harvard Law School, who recently published an article in the Atlantic Monthly called Common Good Constitutionalism. And there's no question in my mind that I find this type of thinking much more problematic on a lot of levels. Because one, it seems very clear to me that he and many of the others who are following this line of thought, when they say common good constitutionalism, they essentially reject the American founding. If you read their writings very carefully, I think that's certainly true. They see the founding as primarily Lockean in nature, and by Locke they have very specific things in mind which I think don't do justice to Locke and the wider Lockean tradition. I also think, however, that the conception of the common good that's being used here is extremely expansive. It also doesn't make room for distinctions between what's called the overall or the universal common good of all peoples and of all times and all places, which is what we call human flourishing, and what is often called the political common good. The political common good being something much narrower by nature and something where the political community, i.e. the government, has a role to play. And even in that case, when the government does have a role to play in shaping the political common good, it itself is quite limited. In fact, I wrote a piece about this called Thomas Aquinas versus Adrian Vermeule, and I pointed out, I think accurately, that in many ways, Professor Vermeule's conception of the common good and the way he understands that vis-a-vis the government or the state is at odds. It's actually at odds with the central tradition of natural law reasoning that he purports to be drawing upon. So there's many different strands of thought among these types of conservatives. They don't agree about everything. They have particular emphases, but some of them have no problem with the American founding. Others clearly reject the American founding. And I think that what is characteristic about a lot of this thought, though, is that, one, when you look at it and you examine it in light of what I will just simply call good economics, then a lot of the policies I don't think make much sense. But also, maybe more seriously, there's a failure to grasp the fuller character of the Western tradition when it comes to understanding the role played by freedom in our societies and the role played by the government in regulating and shaping that freedom.
I think a good follow-up to that.
I don't know why I have an echo.
We can cut that part out.
I have a question just in terms of, Sam, what is the general outlook related to the conservatism right now in the U.S. as you see it? I mean, you know, one of the problems we have is there's a lot of angst surrounding President Trump, probably with a minority, but a substantial minority for sure. And there's a lot of just angst, I think, in the political environment about the direction we're headed. We see continually more and more debt, more and more spending by the government, policies that would be, you know, far from an understanding of conservatism. But, you know, conservatism has been down many roads. It's been down many paths that have been troubling, of course, for a lot of folks out there. But what is your kind of just take on conservatism in general in the U.S. and where we're headed?
Well, there's a lot to say about that, right? So the first thing I would say is that conservatives have never always agreed about everything. There's always been differences on the right about things ranging from economic policy to things like social policy to the precise role of the state, to things like foreign policy. So division on the right is not a new thing. There's always been conservative interventionists in foreign policies. There's always been conservative isolationists when it comes to foreign policy. Even on economic issues, I grew up at a time where free markets became very much the orthodoxy in conservative circles in the West, and including, obviously, the United States. But that wasn't always the case. Up until, I want to say, maybe the 1970s, a lot of the right were more or less comfortable with Keynesian types of policies. So division is not new. What is new, I think, is the depth of the division, the vitriol that goes along with that at the moment. I also think that there's a lot of internal debates that conservatives are having now among themselves, especially when it comes to economic policy and where that fits in terms of the broader conservative agenda. There's also recognition, I think, that many of the aspirations of, let's call it, American conservatism have not been realized to the extent that many people hoped, even when Ronald Reagan was president, right? I mean, the percentage of GDP controlled by the state didn't actually decrease. So I think there's a lot of these fights going on, but there are also deeper philosophical differences that are starting to break out. And we've already touched upon some of them, right? Mm. So some people basically review that anything to do with the Enlightenment has to be purged from American conservatism. There's a large number of American conservatives, a large number now, who think this, the founding is fundamentally irredeemable. Now, that's not new in American conservatism. There were some people saying that in the 1970s, but they're a much smaller group than they are today. So I think you see things in flux. I think there's always a tension between the more intellectual side of conservatism and the more populist side. It turns out that they both need each other, but there's a lot of tension between those types of things. There's also obvious tensions that have emerged as a consequence of Donald Trump becoming the leader of the Republican Party and president of the United States, because that has presented conservatives with all sorts of dilemmas, right? Because on the one hand, they like his positions when it comes to the judiciary and dealing with the problem of judicial activism. They like the internal deregulation, but some of them disagree with him vehemently on his trade policies, for example. So I guess the thing I would say is that division is not new, argument is not new, and some of these divisions are not necessarily new ones. What's different, I think, is the depth of the divisions and the way that they point to some of these deeper philosophical differences about things like the American founding, the role of Enlightenment thought in shaping American conservatism, and what gets priority. Is it economic policy, free market policy that gets priority, or is it social policy? Things like stabilizing the family, promoting marriage, traditional marriage, all these sorts of things. There's a lot of argument going on right now about those issues, which gets priority. And of course, there's always this long-standing issue about the role of the state. What is the role of the state conservatives? And some conservatives have a pretty wide view of what they think the role of the state should be, not just in economics, but in social policy. And then there are other conservatives who lean more in a classical liberal direction, who are arguing we should be very careful before we start taking the state into all sorts of areas of social life, because you may not get the results that you think you're going to get, and you may end up making the situation worse. So if I was going to summarize, it's full of argument, it's full of new but also old divisions, and I don't see these things going away, regardless of what happens at the end of the year with the November 2020 elections.
Brooke, do you have anything else you want to ask Sam?
Well, I know we're running out of time, but maybe we could keep this last question for at least our podcast audience and cut it for the radio, but Sam, I wanted to ask you about cronyism and your thoughts as it relates to just what something here in North Carolina, for example, just as a little bit of background. We have a corporate income tax, but we also have these corporate incentives that our governor uses to bring in certain businesses, and they'll sometimes stay for as long as they're receiving that taxpayer incentive. But a lot of people in North Carolina, I don't think they quite understand just how detrimental that is, and how it's created, you know, these winners and losers in business through a government program. So I was wondering if you could just take a moment and kind of share your thoughts on the ills of cronyism and how that really isn't beneficial to the American people or their businesses.
Well, crony capitalism is something I've written about at length in a variety of forums. And basically what it involves, so your listeners are clear, it involves replacing economic entrepreneurship and free exchange, and therefore free markets, with political entrepreneurship, political exchange, and political market. So it's not as if you end up with socialism. It's not as if you end up with a planned economy. What you do end up with, however, is an economy in which the incentives are shifted away from consumers, what consumers want, what they're prepared to pay for, what they're interested in. And instead, the shift goes towards What do politicians want? What do governments want? And that's not how a free economy is supposed to work, because what happens is that, first of all, it can very easily slide into outright corruption, very, very easily slides in that direction, but it also distorts markets. It means that people are no longer thinking about how do I create new products and services at a cheaper price that I think people actually want, to how do I get the legislator to pass a bill that gives my company particular privileges over others. So you end up picking winners and losers, and governments are generally very bad at doing this. And what I fear with this emergence of, let's call it economic nationalism, partly on the left, but certainly on the right these days, is that you will see the growth, the further growth of political markets. You'll see governments trying to make top-down decisions about where investments should be directed, not based on any sort of rational calculus, but rather on which parts of the business community they hope to get support from. In other words, it basically results in a high degree of dysfunctionality, which corrupts not just the political class, that doesn't just corrupt legislators who stop thinking about the common good and start thinking about how do I make sure that my business friends get privileges from the government, and the business people no longer think about consumers. They think much more about how do I acquire privileges through the political process. That is not what the United States is meant to be. That's not how the founders saw the United States. And it also results, I think, in a steady corrosion of freedom, growing distrust of business and government, and very unhealthy relationships between business and government over the long term, which end up doing a lot of damage to the well-being of consumers. And remember, the purpose of the economy is to meet consumer needs and demands. That's the purpose of economic life. It's not to ensure that particular legislators get elected. It's not to ensure even that certain businesses flourish. The purpose of economic life is the well-being of consumers, their needs, their wants, their desires. Crony capitalism pushes consumers out of the picture, which means that economic life and political life and business life, they all become highly dysfunctional, and the integrity of these spheres of life starts to corrode dramatically. If you want an example of what it looks like, go to New York City. Or why is it the case? Ask yourself this question. Why is it the case that 7 out of the 10 wealthiest counties in the United States are all based in or around Washington, D.C., which, of course, produces nothing economically? Nothing. So that gives you a sense of how bad things are when it comes to cronyism. You end up in the long term creating an elite whose privileges rest upon connections to government, and then there's everyone else who does not enjoy connections to political power. And that is not what the United States is supposed to be about.
That's a great point, because the middle class is such a, you know, the backbone of this nation, and I think they lose out often the most when it comes to these cronyist policies. But anyways, Sam, thank you for joining us today. The book is Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization, his latest book. You can find it at Amazon. Really appreciate him taking the time to be with us today. It's been a great discussion.
Great.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be talking with you.